You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, census figures show that Hispanics no longer make up the majority of U.S. immigrants. We take a look at how the face of U.S. immigration is changing.
First, in his collection of 13 short stories, Children of the New World, author Alexander Weinstein explores an eerie and sometimes dystopian future where advances in technology test the human spirit. His characters relive memories in real time, have android children, and live in lands devastated by climate change. He's coming to Wisconsin for a reading at the Wisconsin Book Festival at 5 p.m. on Saturday. You can find info about his reading and the festival at wisconsinbookfestival.org.
Alexander Weinstein joins us now. Alexander, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
You take us down the road a bit with technology in your stories, things that are in a way plausible, like the robot android who's a cultural companion for the adopted child. What attracted you to make stories based on the just out of reach reality?
Well, I was realizing how strange the world has become, and increasingly so with technology. Just for example, I don't think we have to look any further than Pokemon Go this summer, right, where people were sort of zombies walking around looking for monsters and walking off cliffs. So there's a sort of bizarre technological world that we're finding ourselves in, and increasingly so over the last 10 years, which is the span that I wrote these stories in. And so that made me want to speak about these topics within my stories.
And, you know, because we live in such a device-heavy world and we've got our phone in front of us or the iPad, I'm, you know, walking around with a device in my hand, I could really identify with things that are going that were just out of warranty and just broke on you.
Yeah, totally.
Where did you draw inspiration from when you were writing about things that just don't exist yet, but you brought in some real reality to it?
Yeah, for example, the story of the openness, wherein we have essentially a technological psychic communication going on. That came from, you know, I'd been using Facebook. I use Facebook, but I went on a bus and suddenly I thought, boy, you know, if there was going to be a new technology where people could upload things essentially to their aura, so to speak, right, there would be this sort of hovering layer around their body that showed information about them. You know, this person likes Tom Waits, and this person over here loves Tolstoy. And you could just post this info so that psychically we could pick up on it. It would make for much easier conversation. And then, you know, that was the sort of joke I was having in my head, and I realized, there's a technology right there that's frighteningly close, since we kind of do that already with posting things on our walls and our profiles and on world of online dating is a perfect example of these kind of postings of ourselves.
And you blur the lines between this, you know, what is the future and what is real, like being on the bus. You know, as a reader, I'm always kind of questioning whether the character I'm identifying with actually has a beating heart. So how did you play with that element of what's real and what's not in your stories?
Yeah, you know, the story saying goodbye to Yang is a great example of that, right? Because you have the android robot child who's 18 and you know, looks like a big brother, but then, of course, malfunctions. And while he's clearly a program, he's got programming inside of him, right? He's a robot. He has these secret pleasures that he's not really programmed to know, like he collects butterflies and finds them very beautiful, or spends his allowance on a baseball glove for some reason, right? That's sort of his own private reason. And that's where it gets into this emotional attachment, where suddenly this Yang, this robot named Yang, he seems like he has a soul, right? It seems like he has his own secret life.
We're talking with Alexander Weinstein, who's the director of the Martha's Vineyard Institute of Creative Writing and author of the short story collection Children of the New World. It's being featured in the Wisconsin Book Festival, and he'll be doing a reading on Saturday at 5 o'clock. Saying goodbye to Yang, that short story, I'd love for you to read a passage from it, and it's the scene where the father, Jim, takes that broken android Yang to see if he can be fixed, and Yang is the lifelike android that takes care of Jim's child, Micah. Could you read a passage?
Sure. So this is going to start with the mechanic telling the father about Yang. "He's dead," Russ tells me. "I can replace his insides, more or less build him back from scratch, but that's going to cost you about as much as a used one." I stand looking at Yang, who's lying on the massage table with a tangle of red and green wires protruding from his back. Even though his skin has lost its vibrant color, it still looks soft like when he first came to our home. "Isn't there anything else you can do?" His voice box and language system are still running. "If you want, I'll take it out for you. He'll be able to talk to her. There just won't be any face attached. Cost you $60. Russ is wiping his hands on a rag, avoiding my eyes. I think of the sign hanging in the other room. "Sure," I think. I can just imagine the pleasure Russ will take in cutting up Yang. "No, that's all right. I'll just take him home. What do I owe you?" "Nothing," Russ says. I look up at him. "You know George," he says as an explanation. "Besides, I can't fix him for you."
And it reminds me of sometimes how sterile life can be, when it's just there's A, B, or C, and you just choose, whether it is in the medical world or another area. Talk to me about some of that sterile effect that we have with technology.
I mean, that's one of the really interesting things where, you know, we do make these decisions constantly about online, what are we choosing to click on as a like, right? Or as a not like, or when do you unfriend somebody, right? Or again, I'd been talking about dating, online dating, where you're sending people to the trash, for example, or window shopping for human beings. I think there is this sterility that's coming with our online interactions, where people become a little more expendable, right? Where we're able to block somebody, right? In one of my stories, I say that the new generation has thousands of tutorials on blocking unwanted users, but not a single one on empathy. And so I feel like technology does increase, even though it claims to increase our connections, and certainly it does, there's also a way that it isolates us or makes us much colder in interpersonal relationships and finding real intimacy.
And window shopping for human beings, you know, yeah, like there you draw, you know, the real life into just this really weird, a futuristic place. Where also are you able to draw tension from in drawing from things that we do, like window shopping, but also having that tension with, you know, what is the right thing to do here? You know, what is the right thing to do with technology?
Yeah, that is, I think, what many of the characters in these stories are struggling with, is understanding the demands of the technology, because we all have these new demands. Right? For example, it used to be that if somebody called you or, you know, sent you a letter, you had 3 days to respond, 4 days, you know, whatever it might be. You had a little more time than 8 seconds or whatever it is that we're expected to text back within, right? So there is this kind of demand on our daily lives, right? And that creates a tension of how do we interact with this technology. And then, of course, in the stories, there's a great deal of humanness that's going on, where people are trying to be good parents and good partners and take care of each other, even though the world they're living in has gotten kind of out of control.
We're talking with Alexander Weinstein. He's the author of 13 short stories, a new book out titled Children of the New World. He'll be one of the featured authors at the Wisconsin Book Festival. He's doing a reading and signing on Saturday. I want to take another look at another short story here, talking about the human element, the cartographers. In this short story, we encounter a man who is in the business of selling memories. Can we meet him?
Yeah. This is Adam Woods, of course, right? And he's one of the CEOs brainchilds of this company that produces memories you can beam into your skull, and you know, with a little memory stick, and suddenly you have great memories of vacations that you had wanted to take, or spring break vacations for the kids, and all sorts of different relationships with family members that maybe you had bad parents. Now you can have memories of even better parents.
And could you read a little bit from the cartographers?
You bet. The problem with testing memories was that after enough beams, it became impossible to recognize the difference between authentic memories and beamed ones. Had I really fought in Afghanistan? Cynthia was laying next to me in bed reading a book. It was one of her things. She read actual books. Where she found them, I have no idea. But there she'd be, pillows propped behind her head, reading a novel word by word, page by page, taking endless hours when she could have had the thing memorized in minutes. Did I ever fight in Afghanistan? I asked. You weren't born yet, she said dryly. How about Bermuda? She lowered her book onto her knees and shook her head. The last place you actually went to was your parents' place for Thanksgiving.
So trying to just reconstruct it all, and it gets, that, again, blurring the lines. And I want to ask you, Alexander, in the end, you acknowledge people who are trying to make the world a better place through technology. Mistakes happen when creating this stuff. In such an imperfect world, are we too blame-heavy when things go wrong?
Well, that's a good question. I think in many ways, maybe we're not blame-heavy enough on ourselves, right? Not to guilt-trip everybody, but I do think a lot about what our responsibilities are. Just for example, I talk to my students a lot about this. You know, if we look at the tags in our clothing and we see that they're made in third world countries, well, we're certainly then promoting and supporting sweatshop labor when we make those clothing purchases. And there's a way that we could put the blame on the producers of this clothing, right? Of just in this case, in this example. But there's also the how we vote with our dollars, right? Or and this depends. I mean, I live in Michigan where we have a governor who poisoned the city of Flint knowingly, right? And there's a way that that's not our responsibility. There's somebody to take the blame there. But I do think looking at how we create our communities and the responsibility we take in our own lives and what we support is really important, right? And it's very complicated, obviously, because of how corporate, in many ways, our world has become.
Alexander, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
That was Alexander Weinstein, director of the Martha's Vineyard Institute of Creative Writing and author of the short story collection Children of the New World. You can get information on his reading at the Wisconsin Book Festival at wisconsinbookfestival.org. Immigration has become a hot-button issue in the presidential race, with Hillary Clinton promising a pathway to citizenship and Donald Trump vowing to deport 11 million undocumented, mainly Hispanic immigrants, and building a wall along the Mexican border.
But census figures show that Hispanics no longer make up the majority of immigrants to the U.S., and that the number of Mexicans who are legally in the country has actually dropped sharply in the past 6 years.
With us now is Josh Boak, economics reporter with the Associated Press. His article on the evolving face of immigration is part of the AP's Divided America series, which explores the economic, social, and political divisions in American society. Josh, welcome to Central Time.
Great to be here.
Well, this Divided America series seems to really zoom in on these individual lives, these human stories. We get a human face to immigration. In the process of your reporting on this project, what did you learn about immigration that really surprised you?
I think that there's this tremendous mismatch between the political and public rhetoric about immigration and what we actually see happening in the data. And when we started to drill down into the economic research, when we started to look at the actual numbers in the census and look at some of the changes that happened after the Great Recession, we saw that the debate about the southern border, about unauthorized immigrants, really didn't fully describe the immigration patterns we were seeing right now. And that is that the United States has shifted to bringing in better educated immigrants, largely from India and China. And that changes the economics of immigration because these households tend to earn more. These households are less dependent on government programs, which was one of the critiques of letting in less educated immigrants. And when we surveyed economists on this, the Associated Press talked to 26 economists. All of them said that immigrants make the U.S. economy stronger. So we tried to explain what we saw in the data in human terms. We went to Raleigh, North Carolina to do that because we had a massive pocket of Indian immigrants who worked in the tech and medical sectors.
Mm-hmm.
But then just south, we'd had communities that had been on the verge of population collapse until there was a wave of Mexican immigrants beginning in the 1990s.
And the Pew Research Center said last year that more Mexicans were leaving the U.S. than coming, and it, you know, ending one of the biggest immigration waves in U.S. history. So, you know, when you went to these places and saw this new face of immigration, you know, what are their stories? What are they telling you?
So I spent a lot of time at basically a Hindu temple outside Raleigh. And one of the stories that we heard time and time again was this overall trend. And a lot of the patterns that we're observing now have their seeds in Y2K. If you remember Y2K, that was when it was supposed to turn 2000 and all our computers were going to shut down.
Mm-hmm.
And companies had to bring in Indian software coders to make sure that the computers were okay. And that was many of their first introductions to life in the United States. And after that initial opening, more of them kind of increased their skills. They found opportunities here in the United States, obtained permanent residency, married, brought children, that kind of thing, and really made the United States their home. And this is a critical aspect because if we look at the immigrants right now over the age of 25, half of them are United States citizens. If we were to go back several years, roughly a third of them were. So this is a big change. We're getting more educated immigrants, and they're more likely to become citizens than they were in the past. And that's like the enormity of that change in the gap with the public rhetoric, which is focused on unauthorized immigrants, is just stunning to us.
Immigration, in last night's debate, the third presidential debate, we heard the candidates, their positions on immigration, which mostly centers on immigrants of Mexican or Latin American origin. How do those positions play to the demographic realities that you have been finding and that your reporting highlights?
Well, it's important to note that we still have a large number of Latino immigrants in this country,
mm-hmm.
And they're concentrated in several states, and that in many cases they provide very real services in communities. Often the statistics that say immigrants aren't making contributions to the United States are the ones that compare kind of cost to taxpayers. But if you go to communities like Duplin County in North Carolina, where Donald Trump has campaigned, what you would see is that these workers came into an area that was on the verge of losing population and enabled farms and multiple businesses to stay in existence. You know, one of the secrets to economic growth is you need to either increase population or increase productivity. And the increase in population was critical for keeping the economies of these areas going. Now, the flip side is while Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton have dueled over Latino immigrants, the decisions made by Asian immigrants are really going to matter in this campaign. Shortly after our article came out, Donald Trump actually campaigned at a Hindu center in New Jersey. But overall, Asian immigrants identify with the Democratic Party. And as their numbers continue to grow in the United States, that could become a demographic vulnerability for Republicans, which is one of the reasons why North Carolina Governor Pat McCrory, who's in a re-election battle and has cracked down on illegal immigration inside that state, specifically has been campaigning at the Hindu temple.
In a recent piece in your Divided America series caught my attention, exploring viewpoints of disenfranchised white men in America who say their options are shrinking, that it's harder to find good jobs, and that they want the country they once knew back. And the article reaches into immigration. It also expands into other cultural changes taking place. Wondering how this segment of white males who are feeling marginalized inform this larger divided America discussion and how they fit into the context of what's going on in immigration.
Well, this is a really interesting subject area because we've seen, particularly in this election, older white males with high school educations express tremendous discontent about the direction they see society going and about the place they see in that society. And some of those kind of concerns are rooted in the economics. We've seen that their wages really aren't going up because wages aren't going up for people with only high school educations right now. This is a long-term, multi-decade problem. But secondly, we also see some cultural discomfort, right, in which, in a sense, what's come about is a zero-sum mindset. And that zero-sum mindset is that if someone else is winning, then I must be losing. And if I'm winning, then someone else is losing. That doesn't always work that way in economics, but these voters, based off their experiences, have seen that. And after writing the article, I heard from many people who feel as though immigrants, even educated immigrants, are a drag on society because they take away jobs from U.S. citizens. What economists say is, yes, there are going to be people who are winners and losers in this pattern, but overall, they provide us with greater economic growth. And I think that this is one of the interesting nubs of this debate that after the article I came across is many people said, well, what's so great about economic growth if I don't feel like I'm benefiting from that growth?
Josh, thank you for talking with us today.
It's my pleasure.
That was Josh Boak, economics reporter with the Associated Press.
When you look at that ballot this election season, you'll see more than just two names on the presidential part of the ballot, more than the four names you've been hearing in the news. In all, Wisconsin voters will have seven candidates to choose from, plus the write-in option.
We've invited all seven of those candidates to join us on the Ideas Network for an interview, and today we'll hear from the first of those candidates.
Rocky De La Fuente is the Reform Party candidate for president. He appears on the ballot in some states on the Reform Party ticket. In Wisconsin and other states, he's listed as the candidate for the American Delta Party. I talked to him earlier today. Rocky, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, sir.
Well, before we get to specific issues, what do you bring to this presidential campaign that we're not seeing from the Republican and Democratic candidates?
Common sense, logic, and a little bit of respect to the American people.
Tell us a little bit about your background, how your experience would serve you as president.
Well, I've been basically, my first job was at age 9. My first business hiring employees was age 11. And from there, it's history. I've been doing this for 50 years. When you start at age 9, it doesn't take, you can accumulate the years very, very quick. I currently do business in 4 countries. I do business in California in over 40 cities. And I'm currently doing business in 8 states across the nation, New York, Florida, New Mexico, Texas, so forth and so on. I just met with your mayor of Racine, Wisconsin, and we're talking about creating one of the first projects in the nation in Wisconsin, which will be very good for the Wisconsin economy, because basically we found the cure to no longer be dependent on fossil fuel. And with this new found wealth of lignolenic acid, we'll be able to create millions and millions of jobs, not only in America, but around the world.
What is that? What is that energy source?
Well, the energy source is very simple. You start with corn, you start with wood, you start with sugarcane, you make biomass, which everybody understands it, but it has to be subsidized by the government.
Hmm.
It'll be 100% self-sufficient, and it's basically, if you go to a web, and you go to, and it's called lignolenic acid. It's been working now for 2 years in Europe, and basically it's going to be renewable energy. And basically, we can tell the oil companies they don't longer have to look for oil, and they no longer have to go offshore to look for oil, because we're now going to be able to have Wisconsin, Illinois, Iowa, Kansas, Nebraska, etc., that land is going to go up and skyrocket because we're going to be able to need crops to be able to make this fuel not only for America but to the world.
You've said so, that. Oh, I want to get.
Go ahead.
I want to get back directly into the election a little more now. You've said that the primary and general election systems are unfair to candidates like you who aren't politically connected, part of the political elite. What would you like to see change?
Well, the first thing is the basic. Let's start with basics. We need to make sure that our votes are counted. We make sure that once the votes are counted and there's no election fraud. Today, there's a lot of election fraud. This is going to be the year of most election fraud in the history of America. And I hope that this will be the last year. And from here, we can have election reform. So the one issue is qualifying in the ballot. One issue is this, as you know, I'm currently in Wisconsin on the ballot on November 8th for President of the United States under Rocky De La Fuente. But I tried to basically be in Wisconsin for the Democratic ticket. And I fought it all the way to the Superior Court, Court of Appeals, and Wisconsin did not allow me to participate in the primary. And even though I was not in the primary in Wisconsin, I had a bunch of people that were so kind to write me in. But this time I'm going to make it a lot easier in Wisconsin. People can physically go into the ballot, look my name up, and put the little black mark next to my name.
Now, in the first 100 days of a Rocky De La Fuente presidency, what would be some of your top priorities?
The enormous part is basically getting the company jump-started so we can get a gross national product between 4 and 5%. It's sustainable for the next 4 years and hopefully 4 years later. We need to basically create jobs, jobs, and more jobs because that's what America needs the best. The second thing we need to do is address the immigration problem. And the immigration problem will take a little bit longer than that, but that would be basically the second issue that I need to address. We have 12 million people that basically need to find out what their destiny is. We need to give them a path to citizenship because we need those workers. We need those workers. Those are assets. Everybody calls them liabilities. I call them assets. So we need to get those 12 million people certain because some of them have married American women. Some of them have married American men. And they have American families. And it's not fair that we have them in America. I'm not questioning how they got here or why they're here. But we need to have an immigration policy that's fair, that's logical, and it's enforceable. So I'm cleaning up the mess that has been done by the last 4 or 5 administrations. The next part is education. We cannot grow our economy. We cannot sustain our economy if we don't have education at all levels. I'm proposing the largest virtual reality university and via the internet, that basically will bring the best professors from all over the world so people in America can have university for free 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Because most people that happen to be in this country cannot afford to take time to go to the Ivy League or to any other university. Therefore, they can study between 2 and 4 o'clock in the morning or on Saturday or Sunday. So those three is a handful. In addition, once you have the education and you have the jobs, eventually you get old and you have a problem with health care. So you need to make sure that we can tweak and modify Obamacare so it's affordable to all of them. And you can do that with a couple of ideas, which at this point you can go to my page, Rocky2016.com, and check all the ideas since we have to have a short fuse on this program. And by the way, thank you very much for having me.
Oh, of course.
But then we have other issues that are as important. What are we doing to the people? What are we doing with our veterans? What are we doing with our people for Social Security? What are we doing with our homeless? What are we doing with a abusive government regulation that is trying to do everything they can for us not to create jobs? We are in a war. We are in a war against basically the Orient. We're in a war, an economic war against Europe. We need to understand that we need to make sure that we know that we're in a war and make sure that we're prepared to fight it because we're losing day in and day out. We are losing to other societies that are better prepared to do it. We need to grow. We currently owe $20 trillion. $20 trillion is what's going to be owed by November 8th. and nobody cares that $20 trillion are out there. And if we don't watch that number, your grandchildren, your children, or your great-grandchildren are going to get stuck with the sins of 2020, 2016, 2012. So unless we make a correction, we are all going to be, our grandchildren are going to be blaming us for what we did.
We're talking to Rocky De La Fuente, presidential candidate for the Reform Party. He's on the ballot in Wisconsin under the American Delta Party. Rocky, I want to turn to foreign policy. That's something you've talked about some. What do you see the role of American foreign policy being?
First of all, you need the role of the president has to follow the Constitution. That's his number fundamental right. The first thing he does is he swears to follow the Constitution. And that, of course, takes care of the Second Amendment. And it takes care of the First Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, the 14th Amendment, all of them. And, of course, you understand for Wisconsin, basically most Wisconsins would like to have the right of the Constitution respected in the right to bear arms. So the president has no choice but to basically take care of the Constitution. As it relates to policing the world, as it relates to making sure that the whole world does what they're supposed to be doing, there's nowhere in the United States Constitution that says that's the role of the United States. We try to mess with all the cultures and all the religions all over the world at a cost of $6-7 trillion that we're now stuck with. And yes, we should be involved in certain issues. We should have been involved, but sometimes we get involved in the wrong way. The mess that's currently in Iran, Iraq, Syria, ISIS, we created it in 1980. So we have created that whole mess. We created a whole mess in Afghanistan. And most of the messes we created is because we were trying to be trying to protect oil. Once oil is no longer part of the equation, two things get solved. Our focus can be in the United States. It can be focused on the U.S. citizens. It can be focused on the people in America. But more importantly, we need to focus on global warming. Oil, we are destroying this planet. It's the only one we got. It was given to us by our parents. It was given to us by ancestors. We should have at least the courtesy of giving it to the next generation in the same way it was given to us. And I believe that by us basically putting all our emphasis in renewable energy, we can solve the oil problem. We can solve the oil dependency, we can solve making sure it's renewable, but more important, create millions and millions of jobs. Nobody's focusing on jobs. Everybody's is focusing, what are we going to do to the mess we created in the Middle East? What about the everyday American? What happens to our homeless? What happens to the people that went to war at wars that I don't even want to talk about? They came from Vietnam, or they came back from Korea, or they came back from whatever, and we basically abandoned them. Some of them lost their lives, their brothers, their parents. We abandoned them. We need to have common decency and respect for all those people that have stood up for America.
We'll leave it there for now, Rocky. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, and I hope that Wisconsin can tell the rest of the world that on the top two, none of the above.
That was Rocky De La Fuente, presidential candidate for the Reform Party. He's on the ballot here in Wisconsin for the American Delta Party.
Coming up, we want to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. Did you watch the final presidential debate last night? And what stood out for you as a defining moment for one or both candidates? If you were waiting to hear from the candidates last night before making your decision, do you know who you're voting for? And is there anything that could happen between now and Election Day that would change your mind on who you vote for? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.